Well, hello and welcome to radio. And fair warning, I'm no less cranky than I was last week. This is Ray Weaver, and this is radio, R-A-Y-D-I-O. And yeah, we got a few more listens on the old podcast version last week. So I've decided not to quite kill it yet, because a couple of people wrote to me and said, no, we're listening. So we'll see how that goes. But that's not what I'm cranky about today. Today, I'm cranky about being 67 years old. Not that I mind being 67 years old. It's just that we live in a world where, well, at least in the cultures that I live in, the Western cultures, Denmark and the U.S. and the Western cultures, where age, instead of being venerated, it's people look at you like, oh, you're 67? Well, then, of course, we can't even think about offering you a job. As I mentioned the other week, you know, I was made redundant on the job I currently have. And so I am not even going to bother looking for another job. And the reason is because as soon as they see my age, I won't get called in for an interview. It doesn't matter how much experience I have. It doesn't matter what a track record I have. It doesn't matter whether I've been good or lousy at whatever job I've ever had. They're going to see one thing. They're going to see that I'm 67 years old, and that means I should be in a place somewhere with a bunch of people of a similar age, maybe older, maybe a little bit younger, and we should be sitting there, you know, eating pudding and watching another rerun of Law and Order, listening slowly to our body parts fall off in societies where we're not even remotely valued. I think ageism is the last ism that is allowed in our world. You know, if some of the cliches and some of the prejudices, if some of the things that people think about old people were applied to any other group at all, there would be this huge outcry. Oh, no, you can't say that. I mean, look at the president is an older gentleman, and a lot of the folks that may run against him as well. And constantly, the thing that people are always on guard for, oh, he's senile. He stumbled over a word or two. He lost his train of thought. So obviously he's too old for the job. He's too old for anything. And we don't even know why this old person is appearing on our television out in front of people. But he should be in the background somewhere wearing flannel pajamas. Even in a society as progressive as Denmark, which is where I live, this is a progressive place. A lot of the things that we take for granted now started here. There is no questioning about your sexual orientation. If you wanted to have a sex change operation back in the day, this is the first place that anybody ever heard about that kind of stuff, as far as I knew. All of the, you know, whoever you are, there, I run into very, very little of anything that resembles any kind of racial judgment or anything like that. But age here, same thing. The Danes have a phrase which translates 40, fat, and finished. That's basically the opinion of anybody that's over 40. And I remember a lot of that stupid stuff when I was a kid. And yeah, I bought into it. I don't trust anybody over 30, you know, all of that. So yeah, I'm feeling a little bit, I'm feeling a little bit cranky about the fact that just because I'm of a certain age now, I guess I'm useless. You know, I'm getting ready to go out and do a tour again and play some music and be out on the road for about 2 weeks or 3 weeks or so. And I can guarantee you there'll be someone out there mentioning my age. There'll be someone out there that says something about it, even though I hope I do a good show. I don't think I show any signs of being old or senile or not mobile while I'm on stage. But hey, I am of that age, and I don't do any cosmetic surgery or anything like that to cover it up. I look like I look, and it's just odd. We spend all of this time creating drugs and procedures and ideas and things in the medical community to make people live longer, live longer, live longer. The goal is to live longer. And then when we get to a certain age, we treat those people like, really, you're just too old. You should just really get out of the way. Get out of the way. Now, there's a certain part of me that in some things, I do think that although we should be there maybe at an advisory role because we have seen a few things and done a few things, I really wouldn't mind seeing some younger blood do well in the national political arena because, you know, there are younger people coming up and it's going to be their country. So it'd be a good idea if we had some young ideas out there, not just because they were young, but if they were smart ideas, good ideas, if they matched more the world that that's coming up, the world that has been fundamentally changed by the internet and by the way we communicate now and by the way we relate to one another. I sort of referred to it last week about how it's easy for artificial intelligence stuff to look very wise and very learned because the world, to a large degree, especially in developed nations, is pretty much homogenized and similar anyway. So it really doesn't matter, you know, what the AI comes up with. You're going to be able to say, oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, I'll give you an example. Last week, I was in London to visit my son. He lives in London, and we went to see him. And of course, we did all of the stuff. We did Big Ben and Downing Street and all of it, Westminster, Trafalgar Square. We did all of it. And Abbey Road, of course, music stuff for me. Regent Sound Studios, Denmark Street to look at guitars I can't afford. Yeah, so we did the walking around thing. And so I wanted to see Carnaby Street. When I was young, growing up in Pasadena, Maryland, on the east coast of the U.S., I was a dedicated Anglophile. I was crazy about all things English, the English bands, English sitcoms. You'd have to watch those on public television, Douglas Adams, all of that stuff was fascinating to me. I just loved anything. So Carnaby Street and the fashion and all of that stuff was something that I was just so interested in. I remember a reviewer talking about the time that we're going back a few 100,000 million years, young people, but a reviewer talking about Bob Dylan going electric and Bob Dylan playing electric music instead of acoustic music. He sneered at the fact that Dylan was wearing Carnaby Street fashions, you know, English fashions, very tight suits and polka dot shirts with big graphics and pointy black boots and tight pants. And then, you know, all of the stuff for the mods, the zoot suits and all of that stuff that those folks wore, and I was fascinated by that kind of stuff. I was just so into it and stayed that way through David Bowie and Mark Bolan and glitter rock. It really set me apart in my little neighborhood when the rest of my friends were leaning into the Allman Brothers and flannel shirts and blue jeans with holes in them and cowboy boots and that stuff. And I was wearing spandex and eye makeup. But anyway, that's another story. But anyway, I just wanted to see Carnaby Street. I just wanted to go, you know, I wanted to go Soho and see Carnaby Street. And I did. And Carnaby Street is nothing now. It's zero. It's the same crap you can see in any mall anywhere in the world. It's a Levi's store. It's a Wrangler store. It's a Timberland. It's a North Face. It's all of these chain stores. There's just absolutely not a single trace of anything that had to do with fine English tailoring or anything that had anything to do with, you know, style, or it was just the same stuff you can see anywhere. All fine clothes, I'm sure, all things that people want. But really, you go to London at a place on Carnaby Street to get the same Levi's you can get at Kohl's or Target in the US for $50 less. So it was just one of those things where you see it and you're like, wow, you know, this is, I missed this. I missed this part of this experience. And I'm really glad that I'm having the experience of my son living in London, because I've been wanting to go there since I was a kid. I mean, since I was a kid, I wanted to go to London. I ever since I figured out who the Beatles were and James Bond and all that stuff, I was like, I'm going there, man. I'm going. And it took me a while. It took me quite a few years to get there. But the good thing about it is I'm sharing it now with my son. And that's very good and very important. And he is a musician and a guitar player and a writer and a producer. So I'm seeing it through his 20-ish year old eyes, and I'm seeing it through my 67 year old eyes. And yes, I am 67. If that scares some of you younger people, I would advise you to just tune out right now. So I get to see him having the same kind of excitement about it. And he lives there. He lives there. So he's really enjoying that experience of living in London. And living in London is hard. London is a rough town. The housing crisis is tough. Prices are high. He's a uni student, university student. So for him to love being there so much when it's hard to do, I think speaks to how much he loves it and speaks to his integrity as a human being. And yes, I am kind of bragging on my kid a little bit. So, but I, you know, again, it's just one of those things where I see this homogenization, this centralization, this everything is the sameization. You know, you're walking down the street and you see this great ramen noodle place, and then you realize it's the same as the one you saw on the other street and the one you saw on the other street. And it's hard to find that special little hotel or that special little restaurant or that special little bistro that only has what it has. You know, the old days, I remember you could walk around and most major cities in the world, and especially in the U.S., you'd be walking around the street and you'd see a doorway and you'd realize that there's a little menu out front sitting on the stoop, on the steps of this row house in a city somewhere. And you realize this is a 2 or 3 table restaurant of sorts, maybe an Italian neighborhood, maybe a Polish neighborhood, and they serve what's on that card on the door that day. That's it. That's the menu. You walk in, 2 or 3 tables, maybe in what used to be the living room in the front room there. You sit down and you have a great meal and you pay the price, but it's unique. It's special. It's different. And you get to know where these places are, but I don't know. I don't know that those places exist anymore. I really don't know. I remember there was a hurricane or a winter storm here in Denmark some years back, and it was pretty rough, pretty rough winds and pretty high winds, and it was a pretty rough night. And we were living in a neighborhood close to the one we live in now. My wife was still in university, so she was over at Roskilde University, and she was kind of trapped over there because she really couldn't drive, and they were advising that you didn't drive. So I was at home with my daughter, who was really just a small one, 2 or 3 years old most, and there was a guy who was doing something completely, totally illegal at the time. He was literally running a pizzeria out of his house in our neighborhood. Now, it was kind of a poorly kept secret. Those of us that lived in the little neighborhood, we kind of knew he was over there serving pizzas out of his kitchen. And you would sort of go into where the living room or the front room might be or the front hallway might be. And you'd go in and you'd give your order and you'd get your pizza from the kitchen. And it was totally something that wasn't illegal, but I was very, very grateful for it on the night of the hurricane because he was open, you know, he was open and I could walk down there. It wasn't that far from the house. I could walk down there and get a pizza or two and bring it back. And yeah, I'm sure that there were all kinds of laws being broken, but it was one of those things where sometimes I wonder if all of the rules and regulations, I mean, I know they're there to protect us, but how much protecting are they really doing? I mean, how much protecting are the rules really doing, and how much are they to protect somebody else, somebody who might not need protecting? I mean, I think about the Best Buy dates on food. You know, there are a lot of people, maybe you, that believe that those Best Buy dates on food and yogurt and this and that are something that the government decides. And they're just not. They're just not at all. Those dates are there. They're kind of put on there by the supermarkets, by the manufacturers, by the people who make the food, package the food. They're put there arbitrarily. And yeah, maybe what they're saying is there might be some degradation of the quality if you don't eat it by this point. But really what they're trying to do is encourage you to throw it out and buy new stuff. It's sort of like that psychological obsolescence thing. I mean, do you need a eat by date or a best by date on an apple or a banana? Don't you kind of know? And yet, here we go, perfectly good thing of yogurt sitting in the refrigerator. Oh, this was a day old. I can't eat it. Well, of course you can eat it. Of course you can eat it. Who is this stuff really designed to protect? What are the reasons behind it? Now, the guy, you know, I don't know, but he was selling pizzas out of his living room, kitchen, the neighborhood. We liked it. We liked the guy, and we bought some pizza there. He's long gone. The government caught up with him. Not allowed to do that. Can't go through the crazy process of getting a restaurant open and keeping it open here. I remember I was working for the city of Annapolis. These two ladies came in, and what they wanted to do is they wanted to assemble meal packages, like a lot of people have now, different brands that where you can get a meal assembled and bring it home and then cook it when you get home. They wanted to do this. They wanted to have a shop that did this where they assembled meal packages and you could have the whole meal assembled, chicken and vegetables, potatoes, whatever, pasta sauce. It was all assembled there, but it wasn't cooked there. All the ingredients were assembled and then you took it home and you cooked it yourself. And that was the idea. That was the idea. And there are so many of these delivery services that do this now. These ladies wanted to do a storefront where this kind of thing happened and they would have different meals for people to come and pick up on their way home. And it seemed like such a great idea to me. It just seemed like such a wonderful idea. And I was working for the mayor and I talked to the mayor about it and she thought it was a great idea. And they brought the idea to the city council. And long story short, which is something I never do, they couldn't open up this place where they assembled the meals and gave them for people to take home to cook unless they wanted to put in any full restaurant garbage disposal drain type system, which would have cost, $50,000. It had to have that exact kind of thing that if you're running a gigantic restaurant, the same kind of drainage system, the same kind of garbage disposal system, the same kind of system as a huge restaurant for this place where literally they were going to be putting ingredients in boxes and giving them to people to take home. And of course, they couldn't afford to open the restaurant, so it just never happened. It's just that kind of thing. I wonder, you know, who is that helping? Who is that helping? I don't know. It didn't help those two ladies. It didn't help the people that could have picked up that stuff and taken it home, had a quick meal to put together with their family. I guess somewhere somebody thought it was a good idea. Thinking about again, city of Annapolis, beautiful colonial town, absolutely beautiful colonial town. And what it doesn't have in downtown Annapolis, what it doesn't have in historic Annapolis, downtown in the area, is you don't have any eyes on the street at nighttime because nobody can live in the second and third floors of those old colonial buildings because those buildings cannot pass fire codes. Now, fire codes are ridiculously important, absolutely crucial. They need to be in place. They need to be in place. But does a colonial building, very small building, a very small place with upstairs, maybe a third floor, buildings very, very close together, does it have to have the same exact equipment as a mall or as a superstore or as a place that's 400 times as big that has about 500 times more people going in and out of it? But that's pretty much the way the codes were working then. If they couldn't match those codes, steel reinforced doors between the two buildings, well, that's not possible. These are historic buildings. You can't do that kind of structure. Can't make that kind of structure in those buildings. Can't do that kind of renovation in those buildings. Renovation has to follow the historic codes. Nobody's going to ever be able to live in those second and third stories in these great old buildings, which means there are no eyes on the street at night, which means you don't have the sense of a living, breathing city, town at night, which is what we do have in Europe. In Europe, when I walk through small towns here, Copenhagen, well, it's not a small town, but the small towns in Denmark, the streets are filled and the apartments are filled and there are people living up there and there's always lights on and people on the street and life after 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. There's life. And sometimes I wonder, are we ruling and regulating ourselves to death? And again, homogenizing ourselves to where we're all the same and we all look the same and everything matches the same. And I just wanted to go to Carnaby Street and see a polka dot shirt, probably a purple one. And I didn't see that. So as I said, you know, I'm a little cranky about things, and it's brought on again by the whole AIDS thing. So young people, realize that inside of that old person, that person that you're trying to figure out, why in the hell are they still here? Why are they still breathing? Why are they still taking up space? There's a person in there that has a lot of knowledge. There's a person in there that has a lot of life, a lot of history, a lot of things that you're going through now, they've already been through. Now, their experiences are not exactly the same as yours. And I don't ever try to set myself up as a wise old sage, because that's the last thing I am. But they have value. And they have something that they can bring to the table. And here's the thing that you may not know. They don't really, for the most part, realize that they're old. They're just living their life. Sure, they've passed a certain number of years and certain parts of their body may not be working as well as they used to, and maybe they've slowed down a step or two. But the fact of the matter is, inside their hearts and inside their minds and inside where it matters in their soul, they're still the same person that they saw when they first became self-aware looking in the mirror at 16, 17 years old. They're still that same drive in there. Now, it may be tempered with some lessons of life. It may be tempered with some successes and some failures. But the idea that they're somehow not there, somehow not living anymore, that they're sort of just waiting around to die, as Townes Van Zandt once wrote, no. They still see the world, live in the world, breathe in the world, and are part of the world, just like you are. Well, that's me being radio for today. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it wasn't too downbeat. I'll be on the road for the next couple of weeks, so we'll be getting a radio from the road. Sound quality will be weird, but maybe I'll have some great ideas while I'm out there and play a little music and you get to hear all of that. I am Ray Weaver. This is Radio, R-A-Y-D-I-O. See you soon.